Okay, today I'll be talking about predicted changes in soil organic carbon over 50 years in corn and prairie-based cropping systems. This is some work that I did with Soterios, and my major advisor was Matt Liebman. This experiment took place near Ames, Iowa, on a site that we call the COB site, which is a comparison of biofuel systems. And the whole experiment was set up to ask, can cropping systems designed to produce large amounts of biomass with high net energy return create significant environmental benefits at the same time? So there are six treatments. I should say all of these had no tillage. First we have just grain-based systems, the soybean corn and the corn soybean, just run sort of a standard systems that you might find in central Iowa. Then we had continuous corn, which had 50% of the stover removed as if for biomass removal. We had one of those treatments with no winter cover crop and another one with a winter rye cover crop. And then we had two prairie treatments that started out with the same initial seed mix. And every spring, one of the prairie treatments receives 84 kilograms per hectare of nitrogen fertilization. The other prairie receives absolutely no fertilization. And this experiment was established 7 years ago, so I'll be showing you data from the first 6 years. This experiment also has had a lot of measurements during those first 6 years. First of all, we've taken a lot of soil cores, most of them down to 1 meter depth, and run a lot of soil measurements, you can see there. There are also soil sensors installed in each plot. And these plots are replicated 4 times, so we have 4 blocks there. The sensors measure soil moisture and soil temperature every 30 minutes at 5 different depths, down to 50 centimeters. There's also a very extensive system of tile drainage in these plots. Right here through the center of each plot, we have one tile that drains out basically what is in here, and then we have border tiles between each plot to separate water from each plot. The flow for this is monitored every 5 minutes, and the samples are collected every week for nitrate and dissolved organic carbon. There's also been a lot of plant measurements here, different ones kind of over the last 6 years, but everything basic, a lot of things you would expect, including composition in the prairies. There have been greenhouse gas measurements, CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane. And there's also a weather station at the site, so we can capture temperature, precipitation, and radiation. So you can see that this is really well set up for modeling. And all of this could be really useful in calibrating a model. So eventually decided, we used all of this data listed here except for the leachate data and a couple of the greenhouse gases. What we used this in was APSIM. So APSIM is a modeling platform that includes 60 different models. It's very user-friendly, it's very transparent. You can see all of the source code behind the model, and you can see all of the equations that were used. So it's very nice to use. It's frequently updated. It has been developed by a lot of different people, and it's free to everyone. You can go to the internet today, you can download this model, you can start using it. And it runs on a daily time step at a field scale. So the models that we used for our simulations were the maize model, soybean, and then modified a wheat model for the winter cover crop. There was no model in there for prairies, so we did a lot of modifications to the ag pasture model. And when we were done with this, we were able to simulate 3 different functional groups so that we could sort of see how the competition looked in the prairies that we actually had in the field. For soil water, we used SWIM, which is based off of Richter's equation. For soil nitrogen, we used soil nitrogen. And this included the soil carbon dynamics, which I'll talk about a little bit more later. And for the residue dynamics, the surface organic matter. And I will show you how this worked out. So up here we have continuous corn with the cover crop down here. biomass for corn, soybean, the soybean corn, the fertilized prairie, and the unfertilized prairie. And you can think of the first 3 years as calibration and the second 3 years as validation. And the model performed really well. You can see that there's not a big difference between what we measured and what was simulated. Probably our biggest problem was in 2012 when we had a drought year. And grain yield was very similarly successful. We were very satisfied with how it performed. Here's the root pool from just the prairies. And you can see that Epsom was able to capture sort of an accumulation of roots that you would see in a prairie, in which we saw more in the unfertilized prairie than in the fertilized prairie. But since we're looking at carbon today, this is a very important thing to see, that we could capture the carbon inputs. As far as carbon outputs go, again, we have the continuous corn with the cover crop, corn, soybean, soybean, corn, the fertilized prairie, and the unfertilized prairie. And these are CO2 measurements that were sort of bulk CO2 measurements, and Epsom was able to match up what we saw in the field and what was simulated. So as far as carbon outputs go, we were very satisfied with that. Two other important drivers when we're looking at carbon dynamics: one, soil water content. And remember I said we had all those soil measurements every 30 seconds for 6 years, or every 30 minutes for 6 years, which came in really useful, and also having those depths and being able to see that Epsom was doing a really good job at each depth in the corn, in the prairie, which were two very different systems, two different models. And you can see we captured the dry periods, the wetter periods, and all the way down to depth. So we knew this was important for decomposition, carbon coming into the system. Temperature was also very important. I'm not showing that here, but it looks similar to how soil water content performed. So we had everything set up. The calibration was done. The validation was done. We were satisfied with everything. But we still wanted to know what soil carbon looked like 50 years from now. So we needed some weather data to drive the system. So to get this weather data, we used AgMIP's guide for running AgMIP climate scenario generation tools with R. And this is also something that's available online for creating weather files. It has a lot of details if you have any questions with that. It gives you some options. First option is the representative concentration pathway. We chose 4.5, which is the red one here. So it's a little more optimistic, but it's still conservative. And then you can choose from 20 different global climate models. And we decided just to choose all of them. So we ended up with 20 files that had the max temperature, the minimum temperature, precipitation, and radiation every day for the next 50 years. Before I show you what the predictions look like, I wanted to tell you a little bit more of how carbon works in Epsom. There are four basic carbon pools, or organic matter pools. The biome pool is, well, let me start with the fresh organic matter pool. Is exactly what it sounds like, fresh organic matter, litter, and roots that have just died. Then there's the biome pool, which is the most active decomposing pool, the humic pool, which is a slow decomposing pool, and within the humic pool is an inert pool of carbon, which wouldn't really do anything. So in a no-till system in Epsom, there are two ways that carbon can enter the system. First is residue. Residue goes directly to the biome pool and to the humic pool. But roots enter through the fresh organic matter pool. And this fresh organic matter then goes to the biome pool, humic pool, and a lot of this carbon is cycling around between these two pools. And every time that carbon changes pool, some of it is lost as CO2. So these are the results of the biome pool, the fresh organic matter pool, and then the root carbon pool. Over the next 50 years from 2014 to the 2064. And you can see the biome pool is the biggest pool here, the fresh organic matter pool, and then the root carbon pool is much smaller here in the corn, corn with cover crop, corn, soybean, soybean, corn. This is the fertilized prairie and the unfertilized prairie. And once we initiate the simulations here in the continuous corn, you can see that it remains relatively stable over time. It's actually a really small decrease that you don't see here. It's the same with these two systems. These have a very small decrease. This one stays the same overall. But when you look at the prairies, you can see the huge difference we get by inputting all of those roots. So as soon as prairies are established, we have a huge jump in the root pool, in the fresh organic matter pool, in the biome pool. But after about 8 years, these pools sort of stay the same. They have the same relative difference over the next 50 years, so they sort of stabilize. And you can see here that, that this is about 8,000 kilograms of carbon per hectare in these faster decomposing pools. So if we put this in context with the humic pool, we actually see an overall decrease in carbon in all of the systems over the next 50 years. So these three are the corn, the corn, soybean, soybean, corn. This one right here is the corn with the cover crop. And then these ones are the prairies that don't separate out too much. So even though we did have some slight increases in the faster decomposing pools, we were having decreases all along in the slower decomposing pools. So you might think of it sort of as a priming effect, that we added more carbon to the soil, stimulated microbial activity, and started losing more of the older carbon that had been stored there previously. So as far as the row crops go, this is similar to what some other people have found. They found both gains and losses in soil carbon under no-tillage. There's only been one prairie model in the Midwest that predicted gains in carbon under the prairie. Two really big differences in our systems is one that we had residue removal, which I don't think made a huge effect, but tile drainage is a huge historical difference from what you would think with prairie formation. So when I talk to people, a lot of people say, you know, like, especially in the beginning when I explained, you know, what we were looking into, see if prairies are going to accumulate carbon or not, people say, well, of course they do, because we have these rich soils in Iowa. How do you think they formed? And they formed under really different conditions than what we see in our field. I showed you the picture of how many tiles we have there and how aerobic the soil is probably most of the year. When you think historically, I don't know, there are accounts from pioneers who didn't travel even during the summer in Iowa because the ground was so wet, there are so many wetlands, they had to wait until every winter until the ground was totally frozen just to leave their houses. And you know, it's something that we totally forget when we look out and see farmed landscapes and people living everywhere. So I feel like those two factors made a big difference and how carbon accumulated. And I guess I would just end with the question of asking, how do we add carbon to soils that are already high in carbon in Iowa, since we seem to be slowly losing this carbon? And for questions, I'll just leave this up on my acknowledgments. Worked with a lot of people for this.
We have time for one question.
A lot of the weather simulations after 20, the previous one?
In the bottom you see after 2060, lower.
Yeah, I had a lot of sensitivity to the MET files after 2060. And it looked like on some longer simulations that I ran that rebounded, and kind of consistently across those 20 files there were some events there that just all sort of coincided and we had that sort of drop.
Thank you.